All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm Colin Anderson, and this is my mom, Melinda. We're happy to be speaking in front of you today. God in the Movies is a great opportunity for me because I feel like I'm a growing movie buff. You can regularly see me at the AMC in Columbia. If you do, say hi. And I'm slowly turning my mom into the same. So we're excited to talk about a movie that's made a lasting impression on us in just a couple years since it's come out. Asteroid City was written and directed by Wes Anderson, no relation, who is known for his very distinctive and quirky storytelling. If you've seen a Wes Anderson movie before, you know it's zany to say the least, and there's a certain look to it that you just know you're in for a classic. He wrote the script for Asteroid City in 2020 during the COVID pandemic lockdown, and he says that point in time actually influenced the film's narrative. In the film, uncertainty and chaos take center stage, prompting characters to grapple with numerous things out of their control. They struggle to find meaning in an unpredictable and absurd world. Similarly, as followers of Christ, we can struggle to find meaning in an ever-changing and chaotic world. But as we'll dive into this morning, genuine faith and uncertainty are connected. So, to set the scene for what we're about to watch, the central plot is actually a story within a story. As the movie begins, it's quickly revealed that what we're watching is actually a fictional play about a father who travels to the desert town of Asteroid City with his family in 1955 for a science competition. This makes up the bulk of the film, and these scenes you'll see are in vibrant color, while the behind-the-scenes story, or the top layer of the creation and production of the play, is actually in black and white.
The play revolves around a diverse group of people who converge on Asteroid City for a junior stargazer space cadet event. The tiny town is where an asteroid famously crash-landed, leaving a huge crater and a tiny space rock. The gathering attracts scientifically gifted teenagers from across the country who are being celebrated for their impressive inventions and knowledge of astronomy. The central characters are Woodrow Steenbeck, who is one of the teens being honored, and his father, Augie, a war photographer whose wife has just died 3 weeks prior. Augie planned to drop his three daughters at his father-in-law Stanley's home before returning to Asteroid City with Woodrow. Unfortunately, the family car breaks down, and Augie is forced to call Stanley for help.
Phone booth. Woodrow leans his back against the booth as his sisters play nearby.
President? Romulus, this is Augie Steenbeck.
Good morning, Mr. Augie. The gate is open.
No, we're not there.
You're not here.
May I speak to Mr. Zack?
Yes, Mr. Augie.
A split-screen view shows Romulus speaking with Stanley as a cop car chases a vehicle past Augie. A police motorcycle trails after the two vehicles as people inside fire at each other. At his home, Stanley picks up the phone.
You're not here.
We're not there. The car exploded. Come get the girls.
The car exploded?
Parts of the car exploded itself, yes. Come get the girls.
I'm not the chauffeur. I'm the grandfather. Where are you?
Asteroid City, Farm Route 6, Mile 75. Come get the girls. I have to stay here with Woodrow.
What are you talking about?
The thing for Woodrow is there.
Our view shifts from Augie to the letterboard sign. Welcome, junior stargazers and space cadets.
Hello?
Not the ticket.
Augie turns his back to Woodrow and shuts the phone booth door.
They didn't.
No?
No.
No.
Yes.
You didn't tell them still?
I still didn't tell them.
You promised.
I know. The time is never right.
The time is always wrong.
A profile view shows the Asteroid City sign beside Augie and a golf caddy holding a flag beyond Stanley.
Are you okay?
No.
Augie looks downward.
You never liked me, did you?
I never loved you.
You always thought I wasn't good enough for it.
Yes, we're saying the same thing.
Stanley addresses Romulus.
Gas up the Cadillac.
Okay.
Tell the kids.
I will.
I'll be there when I get there.
Augie and Stanley hang up. Stepping out of the phone booth, Augie glances around. He takes a photo.
It's the end of that car. Andromeda, check under the floor mats. Come on. Pandora, check the side pockets. Cassiopeia, check the cracks between the seats. Take everything.
What do you think, Woodrow?
I think it's kind of sad.
The family strides toward their station wagon on blocks across the street. Words on the wood paneling partially read, French Press International. Augie takes bags from the luggage rack and hands them to Woodrow. Two of the girls toss items from the back seat onto the ground as the third stands and watches. A label on the side of a large suitcase reads, Steenbeck. Over black.
While waiting for Stanley to come and collect his granddaughters, Augie meets Midge Campbell, a Hollywood starlet whose daughter is also part of the competition. And we are introduced to an ensemble of townsfolk, including other parents and their children, a band of musical cowboys, the military sponsors, and a school class on a field trip. I want to preface this by saying this movie is full of like first name actors. Like, you're going to recognize a lot of people. We can't really like go into all of them because I'm just going to say, go watch the movie. You know, obviously you've seen Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, Tilda Swinton. There's lots of people that you will know from other movies, but they play like these, you know, some of them are cameos, and some of them, Steve Carell, some of them have larger parts. Back to the movie. In the middle of all this activity with everyone arriving in Asteroid City, Augie decides it's time to tell his kids the awful news.
Well, this bucket of nuts just stole my quarter.
I beg your pardon.
The manager leans back inside, and the lights on a cigarette vending machine come on. Montana grabs a pack from the chute. A motel employee hammers a number 7 sign outside a tent. The Steenbecks sit near the communal showers.
You're probably wondering why we didn't pack your mother's suitcase. It's because she's not coming with us on this journey. She can't come. She got too sick. And to put it bluntly, after all the surgeries, therapies, and interventions, after 2 years of struggling and suffering, she succumbed to her illnesses.
Augie holds Tupperware.
I'm sorry. I didn't know how to tell you then. I couldn't figure out how to tell you later. I didn't know what to do. The time was never right.
The kids stare at him.
You're saying her mother died 3 weeks ago?
Yes.
When is she coming back?
She's not coming back. Let's say she's in heaven. Which doesn't exist for me, of course, but you're Episcopalian. Come here, let me hug you.
Augie expands his arms and the kids hug him. A patch on Woodrow's shirt reads, Brainiac.
Okay. Sit back down.
The kids comply. Augie looks to his son and smiles.
Did you know already? Woodrow.
A tear rolls down Woodrow's cheek.
I think so.
She'd been away so long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're gonna be okay. Your grandfather's on his way. We're gonna stay with him for a period of time, which is yet to be determined how long it's gonna be.
Is she in there?
Woodrow points to the container.
Yeah. She's in the Tupperware.
Augie sets his hand on the lid.
Cremated.
He opens it slightly and shows them the contents.
Are we orphans now?
Augie looks to Cassiopeia.
Huh?
Are we orphans now?
No. Because I'm still alive. When my father died, my mother told me he's in the stars. I told her the closest star, other than that one, is 4.5 light years away with a surface temperature over 5,000 degrees centigrade. He's not in the stars, I said. He's in the ground. She thought it would comfort me. She was an atheist. The other thing she said, which is incorrect, time heals all wounds. No. Maybe it can be a band-aid. Your concept of time is completely distorted, though. I don't think any of you except Woodrow even understands what 15 minutes means.
15 minutes is 6,200 hours.
Pandora smiles.
Exactly. That's not your fault.
Augie glances down, then stares off. He taps the Tupperware on his thigh.
If you could have anything in the world to eat right now, what would it be?
So, Augie's explanation of death to his children is one of the most heartfelt and relatable parts of this movie for me. Despite his cynicism about death, Augie knows he needs to comfort and connect with his kids. And I know in my own experience, so often at times like this, we try to make it all make sense, right, for ourselves and for those we know and love. And we say someone we've lost is in heaven as an expression of our faith and to minimize our grief, basically trying to bring a human understanding or explanation for something far beyond human understanding. And it comes from a place, obviously, of good intentions, and it feels like the right and faithful thing to say when actually offering empathy and acknowledging the pain of loss may be more universally comforting. And you see that in the scene, I think, with Augie and Stanley. Like, they don't really like each other, but they're clearly connecting over the fact that his wife and his daughter has passed away. And when he says, "You didn't really like me, but she loved me," and he's like, "Yeah, we're kind of, you know, like, we're saying the same thing." On the surface, it seems like Augie is being glib, and I love this line. Like, he doesn't believe in heaven or an afterlife, so he tells his kids, "Let's say she's in heaven," which doesn't exist for me, but you're Episcopalian, right? And it's a funny line, but it's really meaningful, and I think it's a really powerful moment because you can see the divide between Augie's worldview and the faith of his children and deceased wife come together. And he knows that trying to offer definitive answers to them in that moment to his children is pointless. And simply admitting that you don't know is the most amazing show of faith.
As Augie, Woodrow, and the triplets are stuck sorting through their feelings in this strange town, the other students, parents, and adults mix and mingle. As Woodrow wanders off to process his feelings, the rest of the Stargazers in the competition, all sharing a meal together, notice him eating by himself and call him over to join them. After brief introductions about their respective scientific passions, they bond over their uniqueness as some of the brightest young minds in the country. In the conversation, Woodrow has a moment of vulnerability where he shares that his mother just passed away. At first, the conversation understandably falls silent as the rest of the Stargazers are unsure what to really say in response. When asked what his mother was like, Woodrow's only means of answering is just pulling out a black and white Polaroid of his mother from when she was still alive. For a brief moment, the conversation resumes with questions about when he lost his mother, before Woodrow quickly switches the topic back to his love for gravity and his passion for science. In this moment, we see that even the most brilliant and astute people can struggle to make sense of the unknown. Based on Augie's comment we saw earlier, Woodrow may have even been questioning how his faith as an Episcopalian plays into that. Fresh off the confirmation that he lost his mother, instead of continuing a difficult conversation about the unknown associated with loss, he reverted it back to talking about science, which is what he knows best. After this scene, at nightfall, the military sponsors gather everyone in Asteroid City at the crater to view a celestial event. And as you're about to see, the event was much more than what anyone could have anticipated.
Cole ellipses, midnight, 12 a.m. In the crater, Hickenlooper addresses a crowd.
Tonight you're in for a real treat. I don't know how many of you ever observed an astronomical ellipses before. In fact, can we get a show of hands?
She lifts her hand.
Nobody? Wow. Okay. Well, what you're going to see is a very simple dot, dot, dot. Three pinpoints of light inside your refracting box, which may not sound very exciting at first, until you consider how those dots manage to transmit themselves across 1,000 billion miles of space onto that little scrap of black cardboard. Twice every 57 years, when the Earth, the Sun, the Moon, and the galactic plane of the Milky Way all combobulate along the same angle of orbital interest, the radiant energy of three neighboring stellar systems induces a parallel ecliptic transit, thus all but proving the hypothesis of celestial flirtation. The hitch, of course, is that the math doesn't work. But maybe one of you, one day, will be the genius who solves that problem. The event will begin in 30 seconds. Remember, if you look directly at the ellipses rather than through your refracting box, not only will you not actually see the effect, but you will burn the dots straight into your retina, probably permanently. I know that for a fact, because they're still burned into mine from when I was 11 going on 12. That's when I realized I wanted to be an astronomer, which is another story. Here we go.
Hickenlooper steps back to the podium, and the lights go out. Many people put cardboard boxes with small squares of tinfoil taped to the top on their heads. Our view rises to the stars above. Inside his refracting box, Woodrow views a rectangular mirror. A reflection shows three neatly aligned red lights in the sky.
There it is.
But these are just such marvelously luminous colors, aren't they? Very exciting. Does everybody see it?
I don't. I just see a staple.
June turns Billy's box around.
Yipe! It works!
Are you Shelley?
With Midge.
Yeah.
I'm your idol. What's your rank?
Commanding secretary.
I was a cookie trooper myself.
Really? Wow. What do they say in Squad 75?
Shelley wears a cookie trooper uniform. A green light appears. Woodrow removes his box and looks skyward. A bright glow casts everything in a green hue. The others all remove their boxes and look up. The meteorite sits in its cage before the crowd. A hexagonal green spaceship slowly descends toward the crater. The ship stops and hovers a few feet above the bottom of the crater. Holding their refracting boxes tilted away from their heads, everyone keeps their gazes fixed on the ship. A hatch opens in the bottom of the ship, and a white light shines from within. A probe-like device extends, and two bars expand from either side of it. Long, thin black legs step onto the bars. Two needle-like claws stick out of both feet. Oval-shaped pits cover the alien skin. Gibson reaches down to his holstered gun and cocks it. The ladder extends, revealing more of the lanky alien. JJ looks over at Roger. The bald, wide-eyed alien rides the ladder further downward. Its gaze shifts as it descends. The ladder stops a few inches above the ground, and a tripod extends beneath it. The alien looks around, then hesitantly steps off the ladder with one foot. It moves fully into the circle of white light. Bending down cautiously, the alien reaches toward the caged meteorite. A view from the alien's crimson perspective shows the crowd gawking. The creature slowly lifts the cage off the meteorite. It grips the meteorite with both hands and looks around. The alien stands with the meteorite in hand. Augie brings his camera to his eye. He locks eyes with the alien and they stare at each other. The alien poses and Augie snaps a photo. Woodrow glances at his father beside him, then looks back at the alien. Stepping back onto the ladder, the alien carries the meteorite back to its ship. Everyone watches the ladder rise and the circular hatch close. Lights flash on the bottom of the ship, and it silently rises away from the crater. The ship spins in place, then flies off. Woodrow looks over at Augie, who wears a confused expression.
The alien stole the asteroid.
Over black, a slate reads, end of act one.
So, as you can imagine, everything changes when the alien arrives. The sudden event triggers a presidential order to place the entire town under military quarantine, and everyone is subjected to medical and psychiatric evaluations as the government takes it upon themselves to try to pinpoint the alien's intentions. In the midst of all of this, the people who saw the alien know they witnessed something extraordinary, something so cosmically significant that it has to matter for their own lives. But how exactly? The creature descends, takes the asteroid for which the town is named, poses briefly for a picture, and then leaves. But what does any of the absurdity really mean? The next few scenes show us how some of the visitors ask themselves that very question.
It's 3 through 7.
All right.
June teaches class outside.
I'm going to attempt to proceed with the lesson plan I originally prepared. Just to keep orderliness under the circumstances, I expect that some of our information about outer space may no longer be completely accurate, but anyway, there's still only 9 planets in the solar system as far as we know. Billy?
Except now there's an alien.
True, by all appearances. Nevertheless, Neptune, fourth largest planet by diameter, Neptune orbits the sun only once every 165 years. Bernice?
Maybe the alien went there?
Well, maybe. I don't think anybody knows where the alien went or came from. Yes, Dwight?
At first, I thought the alien was kind of sneaky, but now I think he was probably nervous to go to Earth. He's never been here before, I betcha.
Then why'd he steal our asteroid then if he's such a gentleman?
These are all reasonable questions. But at this time, let's stick to Neptune because I haven't had time to prepare any lesson plan on this subject we're talking about.
The alien.
The alien, yes. And by the way, I don't mean to evade your questions. I want to emphasize that you're safe. We all are here on Earth. Your parents have been notified of at least something. America remains at peace. Yes, Montana.
Well, I'd like to parley a notion myself, if I could, June.
Okay.
June steps back, and Montana faces the kids. He takes off his hat.
I figure this here alien come from a tribe we don't know nothing about, do we? Anything we say just be pure speculation. But I tell you what I reckon. I reckon that alien don't mean no harm at all. I reckon he just took himself down here to have a look-see at the land and the peoples on it. In the spirit of exploration. See, I don't look on a feller alien all suspicious-like. No, he ain't American. No, he ain't a creature of God's green earth, but he's a creature of somewheres. So are we. Now, let's show the old feller some hospitality. And if he turns out to be a dirty dog, which I reckon he ain't, well, that'll be a job for the United States Armed Forces, and they ain't never lost a war yet.
He puts his hat back on.
Thank you, Dew.
June faces her students.
I agree with Montana. Now, Neptune.
If I sleep on a cot instead of the sofa bed, that might leave room for me to set up a darkroom in the pool house. Is that possible as a compromise?
A banner on the meteorite billboard reads, closed indefinitely. Quarantine rules in effect.
If I cut across a 14T.
Oh, is that close, the elementary?
How can you two even think about this? The world will never be the same. What happens next? Nobody knows. Will he visit us again? Will he speak to us? What will he say? Why did he steal our asteroid? Was it ours in the first place? Does he like us? Nobody knows.
That's true.
What's out there? Something. The meaning of life. Maybe there is one.
I hope you're still a Piscatalian.
You took his picture, Dad.
Walking together, Augie, Woodrow, and Stanley pause by the service station.
I'm a photographer.
Woodrow looks from his father to his grandfather, then walks away.
Episcopalian.
Augie and Stanley continue on. Woodrow takes out his notebook and writes.
You really want us, Stanley?
No, but you need me.
She did love me, you know.
Who says she didn't? I've been on my own for 12 years, after all, and remember, my wife drank herself to death.
Drank herself? I don't know what that means.
In my loneliness, or perhaps because of it, I learned not to judge people. Take people as I find them, not as others find them. And most of all, to give complete and unquestioning faith to the people I love. I don't know if that includes you, but it included my daughter and your four children. So you're welcome to stay with me for as long as you wish, whether I like it or not, which I don't, by the way.
Sitting on his car's hood, Augie takes his pipe from his mouth.
Stop helping us. We're in grief.
Stanley stares at him.
Me too.
Augie puts his pipe back in his mouth. Stanley pretends to choke him. He lowers his hands. Woodrow approaches his father.
Are you planning to abandon us? I was. As a temporary measure.
What?
But I decided against it.
I knew it. I sensed it.
I'm not the wet nurse. I
would have hired a babysitter in addition to you. I'm not planning to abandon you anymore, even as a temporary measure, which is all it ever would have been.
Woodrow looks thoughtful.
I forgive you for considering it.
Watching these characters struggle to make sense of the unknown is like so many of our faith journeys. We have faith in God because God has revealed himself to be good and loving through Christ. But we also know that God's actions and plans cannot be fully understood, and we'll always be faced with questions we can't answer.
In Scripture, we are told to have faith and trust God's timing, even if it doesn't align with our own expectations. In the book of Isaiah, we read, "My thoughts are nothing like your thoughts, says the Lord, and my ways are far beyond anything you could imagine. For just as the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." And in the book of Proverbs, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to him, and he will make your paths straight." Popular Christian writer Anne Lamott also reminds us that faith isn't easy. And I love this quote because it just feels so real. We often talk about the opposite of faith is doubt, and I think she really nails it here. "The opposite of faith is not doubt, but certainty. Certainty is missing the point entirely. Faith includes noticing the mess, the emptiness, and discomfort, and letting it be there until some light returns." Having faith means recognizing that life is unpredictable and the future is unknown to us, yet trusting that we are securely in God's hands. And I've read this quote a lot recently because this world is crazy right now. And I think being comfortable with the discomfort and the mess, as however we might define that, is really important, and just until some light returns. So trusting God, trusting his divinity, especially in difficult times when life feels confusing.
As Woodrow and the rest of the Stargazers are secretly trying to contact the alien, Dr. Hickenlooper catches them in the act, but she admires their courage to continue exploring. As she pulls Woodrow aside, she says, "Your curiosity is your most important asset. Trust it." In this scene, we see the importance of not shying away from uncomfortable situations, but leaning into them with faith. Just as Dr. Hickenlooper tells Woodrow to trust his curiosity, we should trust that God will guide us through any times that we can't fully understand. Eventually, the Stargazers continue their scheming, the story of the alien leaks out to the rest of the country, and Asteroid City becomes a tourist attraction. As the military prepares to lift the quarantine, suddenly the alien actually comes back and returns the meteor. As the general attempts to restore order among everyone in attendance, chaos ensues and everyone revolts. In the middle of this chaotic scene, which, as a reminder, is taking place within a play, the actor who plays Augie walks off the set. He barges in on Schubert, the play's director, because he just still doesn't understand.
"I still don't understand the play."
He hurries away.
"What?"
He steps over to the crater wall. He goes through a door and emerges in black and white backstage. The host turns.
"Where are you going?"
Jones Hall removes his beard.
"I'll be right back."
He walks past hair and makeup.
"I don't play him as an alien, actually. I play him as a metaphor. That's my interpretation."
"Metaphor for what?"
I don't know yet. We don't pin it down."
"Schubert! Schubert! Schubert!
Huh?
Schubert!"
"Yes. What's wrong? Are you on?"
"Technically, but General Gibson just started the scene where the president doesn't accept his resignation. I've got 6.5 minutes before my next line. I need an answer to a question I want to ask."
"Okay.
Am I doing him right?"
"Oh. Well, I told you before, there's too much business with the pipe, with the lighter, with the camera, with the eyebrow, but aside from that, on the whole, the answer to your question is enough."
Jones sits in the apartment set and Schubert kneels.
"You're doing him just right. In fact, in my opinion, you didn't just become Augie. He became you."
"I feel lost."
"Good."
"He's such a wounded guy. I feel like my heart is getting broken, my own personal heart, every night."
"Good."
"Do I just keep doing it?"
"Yes."
"Without knowing anything?"
"Yes."
"Isn't there supposed to be some kind of an answer out there in the cosmic wilderness? Woodrow's line about the meaning of life."
"Maybe there is one."
"Right. Well, that's my question." "I still don't understand the play."
"Doesn't matter. Just keep telling the story."
As Schubert tells Augie, his understanding of the play is much less important than his willingness to fully engage with it. It doesn't matter what the play means, he should just keep telling the story. Do I just keep doing it? Yes, yes. Without knowing anything, yes. The journey of faith is not always smooth, but God has a plan and a purpose. Do we just keep believing his story? Yes. Without knowing anything? Yes.
Thank you for allowing us to present this movie. It's, as you can tell, a little bit of a mind bender, and we wish you could have shown the whole thing because it's just an amazing film. It's very layered, and there's lots of messages about loss and grief, about bonding, and it's a movie that, as Colin mentioned, he's a big movie buff. I'm like more late to it. And when he first suggested this film, I was like, huh? but then I watched it again, and we watched it again, and I could really see that the messages of, you know, uncertainty and the idea of faith and those being able to coexist came across really strongly. So thank you for allowing us to present this morning. We are now going to take communion together, and if the worship team can please come forward. Communion is simply trusting that Jesus is with us and reminding ourselves of that reality every week. Jesus broke bread and drank wine in a meal with his closest friends before he died, and we do the same to remember that he said he would never leave us. When you are ready, please come and take a piece of gluten-free cracker and some juice. You can eat at the tables at the front or on the side, whatever feels most comfortable for you. You can take communion at the tables or take it back to your seat. There are also other ways to respond at this time. You can light a candle as a form of prayer in the back and as a symbol of light. At the rear of the auditorium, or visit one of the other stations, the racial justice station, and the other stations around the room. All the information about these is on the front of your bulletin that you received when you came in this morning. So please come forward now to take communion. ¶¶